You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at KBOO.FM.
All right, cool. So I'm here with Sean Jordan. Sean, you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. I hear you. Right, I hear radio you. Sounds different than you sounded a second ago. You sound like you're on the radio.
This is KBOO 90.7. This is Comic Insight. We're on the fifth Monday of a month. If you heard it before, great. Probably not. If you have not heard it and this is your first time staying home and listening, basically what I do is we get some really cool comics. We're going to talk about the material, how they come up with it, and we're lucky enough to do it over a phone. I hope everybody, first off, is staying home and staying safe. But that out the way, let's move on to who we got. Sean, thank you for joining us.
Well, hey, thanks for having me, bud. I'm thrilled about it.
So we'll just jump off the top. You started in South Dakota doing comedy, right?
I sure did.
How long ago did you start?
Well,
you got a radio voice too, by the way. I've never noticed.
I suppose. Well, I do a podcast, my friend. So,
you get to
flip into that mode pretty quick. I suppose it was about a gentleman 14 years ago that I started for real.
Yeah.
I was at work. I was working at a call center. And I bet I've told you this before, but I was at work. I was at a call center, and some kid, I think his name was Casey, and he goes, "Hey, there's a stand-up comedy contest. You should be in it." And I was like, "Yeah, I can do that. I'm funny." And can we swear?
Yeah, it's after 10 o'clock. So you can say what the fuck you want.
Just making sure. I didn't wanna. Anyway, I might actually
shut me down, dog. Go ahead. This is the time to do it. I'm remote.
So. We're at work, and he goes, "You should be in this comedy contest." And I was like, "Yeah, dude, I got this. I'm funny." You know, exactly what you're not supposed to do. And so I went. I didn't have any material or anything. But anyway, yeah, it was about 14 years ago I did that, and I have learned quite a bit, I think.
Well, it's always funny to me how people start. Like Dylan Jenkins, he started at a grocery thing where they had like 400 of his friends there, and he got to like murder for his first time. So when you went for a competition, how much time did you have to do?
I want to say like 3 minutes or 4 minutes or something. And the thing is, when I went, I didn't have any material, like zero. I had a couple premises written down. And if I'm understanding right, we'll get into our process. So that
kind of
the process. But I had a couple premises written down, and I just went thinking I would just kill it. And I did so bad. So bad. And,
how long did that 3 minutes go? Like, how long until you were burnt out of all your premises and you're sitting there like, "Damn, I still got time"?
I mean, 30 seconds. And the rest, I just like, no shit, man, I swear. Here's one thing I remember vividly about that is I sat in the crowd, which is a weird thing. I see a lot of people who start now, they do it too. You sit in the crowd and you watch the show.
Yeah.
You shouldn't do that. You should be in the back getting ready. But anyway, so sitting in the crowd, and I had on a gray T-shirt, and I didn't think anything of it. I didn't think I would sweat or anything. It was a gray, one of those gray army shirts. You know, cool.
Yeah.
So by the time I got up, I had enough pit sweat that it actually went up my armpit. I think the cotton, like, soaked it up enough to where it was sweating up. So there was, like, sweat up, like, inches above my armpit.
Yeah.
I had to go up anyways. And then when I got done, I remember I don't remember anything about being up there. Nothing at all. But I remember when I got done, I came and I sat back in my chair in the crowd, which is such a weird move. I sat back in my chair. And then I drank a whole pitcher of beer because I was so nervous. I was shaking so hard. And I drank the whole thing, and it didn't affect me at all. I was just sitting there, like, terrified, like, "Oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God." And I drank it like a jock, like, right out of the pitcher, too, like one of those assholes at a party.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I remember it was so bad, but I did well because you could bring people. So I brought probably 70 people, no joke. There were like 150 people could be in there, and I think I brought like almost half the people.
So something that always fascinates me too about stand-up is like no one really does well on their first time, but people.
Ian did.
Well. Cool. Yeah, he's one of the best. He's one of the smartest comedic minds I think I've ever met.
Bring it up. I remember when I watched him, like, I don't think I saw his first time, but I saw him real early on, and I'm just like, "You dickhead. because we're all figuring it out, and he just had it. But yeah, for the most part,
I mean, yeah, I heard like Kevin Hart did well at his first time. I mean, there's going to be some people who are naturally gifted, but I think for most stand-ups, it's a grueling process of getting not shitty as opposed to being good.
Sure. Yeah. I mean,
okay. So I mean, like you're not doing well. What kept you going and kept you doing comedy?
Pretty fun feeling, man. Like when you, I always say this, like if I talk to somebody who's new or if somebody asks me, because people are real quick to shit on a brand new comic. They're real quick to, because, you know, if you hear somebody do a taboo joke, say like a rape joke or something, we all know that you should probably not do that stuff. You're never going to do it well and, you know, da da da. But people think they need shock and all that. So I've always been a big advocate of like, tell somebody they're doing it wrong first. Like, tell somebody like, hey, maybe don't say those words or do a joke about that. And then if they keep doing it, then write them off. But people are so quick to write someone off. If you heard some of the first jokes I did, holy bucket. They were so, I won't say them, but I'll tell you at lunch, but some of them were so bad and so gnarly that I'm like, how in the world did someone not kick the shit out of me after a show? Because I just didn't know any better. And a lot of people don't know any better. To get back to the point, so now, like, if you do a joke like that, you're going to do bad. But yeah, the feeling of doing that, like, knowing that you got up and you did it, even if you did terrible, you got up, you stood up in front of those people, you said your ideas or your jokes or whatever you have, and they reacted anyway, and then you got done and you didn't die, and you're just like, man, that is such a crazy rush. Like, I kind of equate it to if most people, if they were about to get in a fight, that nerve that they feel, that's kind of what you feel before you do stand up when you're starting. And then when you get done, it's like you just beat the shit out of that person or something, where you get off stage and you're like, whoa, that's crazy. I can't believe I did that. And, you know, it's a much less violent way to get that rush, and you're so proud of yourself, and it's so motivating just in life, where you know that you can do that. So you're like, I can do anything. It just, you feel like 10 feet tall, and it's crazy. So that's what keeps it going. And then, you know, and then there's little steps in between everywhere, like where you get something, you get your first paycheck or something from stand-up, and that's like, that gasses you up for like another 6 months, and then you get to go on the road and all this stuff. So there's always steps to keep you going, but that first one, do bad or do well or whatever, you're like, I did it. And that, for me, that was the feeling of like, okay, I need that in my life for the rest of my life. I got to have that feeling somehow.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, they'll do like a bucket list. Like, I just want to do a stand-up open mic or something. And they don't necessarily have that, let me keep doing it. So the fact that there are people who, let me keep striving to reach this feeling is, I think, what makes a good comic a good comic.
Yeah, dude, I was listening to a podcast about skating the other day. Surprise, surprise. And somebody said on there, like, everyone gets a skateboard for Christmas when they're like 10, and then they get hurt once, and they're like, oh, I don't want to do that anymore. Same thing. Like, a lot of people, if you try to stand up or whatever, and they're like, oh, that sucks, everybody looked at me funny, they don't do it. But the ones who stick with it, you know, it's always for the right reasons. So it's just such a fun feeling, man. By the way, my bucket list, I have Bowl of Perfect Game and Slam Dunk at Basketball. And I don't see those things happening.
I don't know, man. The NBA is looking for anything right now. They might be able to let you in. Lower the rim.
Do you think I have a better chance of bowling a perfect game or dunking a basketball if I train for like a year?
Oh, dunking a basketball.
Do you think I could get up there?
Yeah, because I think bowling a perfect game is going to be much more mental. And then when you hit seventh strike, that eighth strike, you're going to start wobbling.
Yeah. And basketball, you've got to get up there once.
Yeah,
yep, I've always thought that same thing. So, anyway, before I die.
We're going to try to find a way to make that happen. We're going to get into your process later. But first, I kind of want to ask, for people who are listening who don't necessarily know you, which would blow me away, because if they're listening, they have to know me, and then they would know you.
That'd be awesome.
But you're in a pretty popular podcast, All Fantasy Everything, with the aforementioned Ian Carmel that we talked about, David Bory, you have guests. And it's a really good podcast. Like, it's a phenomenal podcast, but it's mostly just sitting around, like, shooting the shit about drafting, you know, random things. To me, yeah. that is a way different muscle than stand-up comedy, yet you seem to be very good at both. Is there a correlation between stand-up and podcasting, or is it just you happen to be blessed at doing both things?
Well, you're absolutely right, Nick. I am very good at both, so I'm glad we covered that.
On record, too. Yeah, yeah.
Adam brings this up. My friend Adam, he brings this up to me a bunch. But when I first moved to Portland, when I met Ian, and I remember we'd sit around and we'd just be talking, and I'd always say, like, if somebody had just recorded this, I bet you it'd be fun to listen to, because that's how half of my stand-up is. Like, you just kind of sit around and talk and bullshit with your friends, and then you're like, oh, well, that could be funny, and then you just do a bit about it. Mm-hmm. So that's all a podcast is. I mean, I said it before, like, early on when we were recording a few of them, I'd be like, hey, you should write that down and do it, and Ian or David, they'd be like, no, that's, you know, takes away from this, like, there was just for this.
Right.
But I bet we've burned hundreds of premises just, like, sitting around, you know, just talking. But that's what makes it so fun, is you're just, it's so low stakes, and you're just hanging out with your friends and being funny, and you don't have to do anything. I don't even wear pants half the time. I got mesh shorts on when we were there.
Mesh, maybe. I mean, everyone hangs out with their friends, and it's, like, funny to your friends. But I think there's something special about being able to record it and have that go out to hundreds of thousands of people, millions at this point, and they also think it's funny. So
yeah, man, they are different. Like, so one thing you figure out with stand-up over the years is, like, you have to kind of figure out when you... You can kind of choose when people laugh and what they laugh at, because it's not always set up punch jokes. Like, it never works when someone says, oh, you're a comedian, you should tell me a joke, and you're like, well, it doesn't really work that way, because with stand-up, it's so different, because it's the whole environment. It's like the lights and the club or the venue or whatever. The lights are out, there's a mic, there's a spotlight, everybody knows what they're there for, they want you to be funny, they want to be entertained, they take their cue. Like, if it's a, you know, if it's a good show, you give the cues and the audience takes the cues of, like, oh, that's the funny part, and they laugh. So there's it's so much more nuanced than people think. It's not just hopping up and being funny, although that's, like, most of it, but there's so much that goes into it to be good at stand-up, and you have to know that, and I don't think anybody ever fully, you know, even, like, your Kevin Harts or whatever, they're always working to be better, and that's, you know, with a podcast, you're just kind of sitting there talking, and you forget that there's people listening, because there's no audience, you're just sitting around, so the cues aren't really there. It's just more of a natural thing with your friends. It's like sitting at lunch on a Sunday where you're just like, man, this is fun, this is exactly what I want to do, and, you know, people get to be a part of that. Same thing when I listen to all the podcasts I listen to, you just feel like you're sitting there next to these people, because you don't think of thousands of people listening, you think of, all right, it's me and these four people on this podcast, so there's five of us right now, so I'm just right there with them. But yeah, it's way more intimate, way more that direction than podcast, where stand-up is, you know, it's like a big event, and there's people, and they paid for tickets, and they're having some drinks, so it's they're wildly different.
This is KBOO 90.7, KBOO. I don't know when I'm supposed to do this, because I am still remote. Comic Insights, I'm here with Sean Jordan. I'm Nick Harris.
That's what, like, if Laura wants to go to the mall or something, I go, hey, boo, let's go.
They're going to have to pay you for that one.
Hey, boo.
I think they'll pay you for that one.
Hey, want my stream?
To the radio?
Hey, boo. I'll take
hey,
my
boo.
Hey, boo.
Hey, boo. Gotcha. I've seen you do new jokes not too often, but what is your process? Like, if you are hanging around with your people and you're like, oh, that's a good premise, I should try that, what's the process from that going from that point to you doing that on, like, a theater stage?
I'm bad at sitting down and writing, so I just have to try. You know, you saw it a couple months ago, I tried to do a bunch of new stuff and it all sucked, and that's kind of my process, where it's like, oh shit, because for me, a lot of times I can't necessarily write a punchline. I can't think of one when I'm sitting down trying to write. But if you put yourself in the situation where you're in front of people and they expect you to have a punchline, you better, more often than not, I'll come up with one just because I have to.
Right.
But, you know, the other night, I didn't come up with any. And I remember even talking to you, I was like, that was bad. And you're like, yeah, it was. It was. Is well, that kind of, I mean, for me, that's how it goes. Like, if I have to eat shit a few times, so be it. But that's kind of where I get how I work things out, is I just have to do them on stage, which is funny because right now I can't. So I've just been trying to write stuff. I'm excited, actually, for when, well, of course, I'm excited for all this to be over, but right. when it is, people are going to have so much new material. And I don't think a lot of it's going to be about a quarantine situation. I think a lot of it's going to be kind of adjacent to that, but I think people are just getting real creative right now. So I've been working on writing and just sitting here and writing punchlines. But yeah, my process for real is kind of trying to work it out on stage as best I can.
I also think people are going to realize how much stand-up needs to be worked out on stage when this is over. You know, like,
well, yeah.
I know people who are really good at writing comedy, and they're authors, and they do stuff like that. But actually taking that onto a stage and getting people to laugh at that through, you know, whether that's a punchline or a cue or a marvelous idea, that is completely different.
Yeah, it's hard.
So, yeah, I think it's interesting that you, because some people do write things, and, you know, they're very meticulous, and they'll write all the ums and their likes. And then some people will go up on stage with nothing and then try to figure it out. So I'm always fascinated when people are like, I'm just going to go on stage and figure it out. How many times do you have to bomb on something until you're like, I can't figure this out?
I mean, years, dude. There's some that's been years. There's a joke, you know, that I got a... There's a joke that I do now that's a very good joke. But I tried it years and years ago, and I couldn't figure out how to do it. And Noriko one time told me that he's like, man, I just like the idea, because I was just riffing one night, and I said something about it. He's like, that's just such a fun idea. I was like, yeah, maybe I'll try it now that I'm a little better at stand-up, and then it works. So, I mean, sometimes... There's so many jokes, dude. I have a joke I want to do about how there's no such thing as a private detective anymore, and how they go into the office and they're like, hey, I want to be a private detective, and how they want to live in black and white, and how they want to be a gun, all this stuff, and I still can't figure it out. I've been working on that for like 10 years. I'm like, I don't know how to do it, but one of these days I'll figure it out, and then it'll be good, hopefully.
Well, that's
yeah, it takes a while.
We have a friend, Shane Torres, who had a joke about undercover cops being named John.
He sure did.
He really worked on that really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And it never worked. Never worked. But what's fascinating, especially about stand-up, is that you have this premise, you've been working out forever, it never works. And then somehow, sometimes, something you'll say will click into that, and it'll go into a whole different bit, and like bloom into something you may have never seen coming. So is there anything that you've worked on where you're like, all right, this is never going to work? Somehow it clicks with something else, and then it becomes something that you didn't see.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of personal stuff about my dad. So I used to just kind of, in the middle of my set sometimes, I'd be like, yeah, my dad sucked. And it would bum everyone out. Because sometimes I'd just stop, and I'd be like, yeah, he was a meth addict for a while and stuff. But I wouldn't have any jokes, and then one day I was like, you know, you could make that funny, and then you make it funny, and now I have jokes about it, and it's fine. But yeah, there's most things for me anyways, they start off as like something I say, just kind of riffing on stage or something, and then, you know, people laugh, and you make a mental note of it, and then you write it down after you get off stage, and you're like, okay, so I should try to flush that out a little more, and like, work it into a joke at first, and then over time it becomes its own joke, and then that's honestly how I got most of my act. And to be clear, that joke, that the Shane's undercover cop joke, I did see it work eventually. It was just
it was
so funny to watch him do it and just build it, because he wrote an article about it. He chronicled the whole thing.
Yeah, that's why it's one of my favorite things that I've ever seen, because he really really struggled with it. He did get it off.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was always a funny process. We had like, or a thought where you had like everyone's name Johnson and who was the first one, and like it was a brilliant thought. And that's, I think the catalyst to me thinking like, okay, you can have a brilliant thought, but how do you bring that into a comedy scene and make that something funny and something that people will laugh at, and how do you chip away at it to make it digestible for someone who's had like two or three drinks?
Yeah, it's tricky, man. And there's always, you know, another thing, you kind of figure out how to, the whole room is like, kind of look at it like a person, the room, yeah, or the crowd or whatever, essentially kind of develops a personality, like a dominant mm-hmm. personality in the room. You know this from working at a club.
Yeah.
Like, if there's enough idiots or assholes, I don't want to generalize, but like, if somebody shows up drunk and they're going to ruin the show for everybody, if there's enough people like that, that turns into the audience, unfortunately. So you kind of figure out how to cater to that part of the audience. I hate it when you have to do that, because then the people who paid and want to see an actual show kind of get the shaft. But yeah, you have to.
I don't know if people realize how little they matter in a comedy show. And I don't mean that like in a mean way, but the crowd does become one thing. Like, I've seen crowds where this is what we all kind of laughing at, and they're kind of looking at each other to see what can we laugh at and what are we laughing at and what's funny to us. And it's a mm-hmm. it's a wonderful thing to watch when someone can't, all right, I'm gonna deal with this crowd, and then the late show they're dealing with that crowd, and then, you know, the early show Saturday they're dealing with a different crowd. And to watch somebody be able to mess with all different crowds is a skill unto upon itself.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what comes with the whole thing. You do it enough, you see enough, you know, types of crowds, and you just figure it out. You're like, all right, so this is the set that I'm doing for this particular show. The later drunker show is always, you know, you swear a little more, you're a little looser.
Right.
You gotta let them know, like, hey, I've been drunk. You just have to let them know, like, hey, I get it. You're not the only one who knows how to do that.
I'm a cool dude, too.
Yeah, don't worry. Don't sweat. I got you.
I guess I also want to know, so we were talking earlier about how if someone stepped in over boundaries with things like taboo subjects, or hey man, that's not something you really want to talk about, or hey, check this out, that's not really what you want to get into. How are your thoughts about hack premises? I mean, do you try to stay away from those, or do you let those kind of go into your act? Hack being something like, you know, I have resting blank face, you know, like things that are kind of not taboo but played out.
Yeah, you know, you realize they're played out after a while, and then I try to get rid of them. A big one is like, you know, I look like X had a baby with X or something. That's one that I've noticed lately. I look like a tree fucked a, like a Buick or something. I don't know. Just whatever. And then you're like, okay,
dog, why are you giving my X out?
Because everyone's got one. I had one. And, you know, there's things like that. So they kind of fall into that. But I don't know. If it's funny, it's funny. And if you got your own little sauce, like, one of my favorite things about stand-up is everyone has their own little sauce, and that's what makes it funny. Like, if you know, you could get 10 people doing the same joke, it's all going to be different. I mean, even if it's verbatim word for word, you're still going to do it differently, and it's going to be a different joke. But like, if you wrote it on a piece of paper, you'd be like, okay, I see how that's funny. So, I don't know. If you're good and you make it funny in your own way, I'll let anything ride. I'm not sweating it. I mean, you shouldn't, like, you know, you should never, like, steal anything, but if, I mean, how many people have a joke about dating or kids or whatever? Like, it's all got to come from you. So, you know, I was just watching Tom Skerritt last night, and he has so many funny jokes about having kids, and a lot of people are like, well, you know, I don't want to hear about your kids or whatever, and you're like, well, if it's funny, I want to hear about anything. Like, he talks about
as long as you can make it funny.
Yeah, talk about boxing for an hour. I don't give a shit. As long as it's funny, I don't know anything about boxing. But if I'm laughing, then that's great. I don't care. I just want to laugh, and I want you to make something funny, especially if I don't know what you're talking about. It's almost more fun that way, if I have no idea.
Well, I think I don't want to say the key, but the trick with comedy is relatability and being yourself on stage, which seems, you know, like it'd be easy, but that's why it takes people years to figure it out, is learning how to be yourself on stage. And so if somebody is talking about kids and they don't have kids, it becomes unrelatable because they're not being their true self.
Yeah.
You know, it's a exaggerated version of that, but yeah, it's so I think that it's important for people to talk about what they can talk about, because then it becomes a lot more funnier to the audience.
Sure. That's why I can't. The amount of time stand-up, like, there was no diversity in stand-up is so crazy to me, because it's like, for the longest time, it just seemed like it was all straight white dudes, and you're like, man, most people would be like, okay, but I want you to talk about a little something more, like something else, like maybe something I'm into, or like my life. So I can't believe it took as long as it did. But,
well, I think that's why Def Jam was such a huge thing.
Yeah.
Because if you had to go
finally hear somebody being like, cool, this is how I grew up. That,
right.
Because you do want to sit, you know, like if I saw some comic talking about skating, which there's like two or three, I'd be so stoked if they could make it funny, you know?
Right.
Like, but there's only two or three that do it. So, yeah, just whatever you're into, you want to be able to identify with the person up on stage. That makes it so much more fun.
Mm-hmm. And then, so the last question I always ask is, what does comedy do for you? Like, so you started, you know, 14. Damn, 14 mm-hmm. years ago.
Yeah, it was a while ago, man. I was like, I was early, you know, early 20s, probably 24. And don't you worry about it. I won that Sioux Falls Comedy Contest, by the way.
Oh, no doubt. You had 75 people in the crowd.
Yeah, I probably had more. So the second round of it, so the first round was all audience votes.
Yeah.
So that's how I won the first round. Second round was half audience, and then they had six judges, like, you know, like some radio DJs and shit.
So okay, yeah.
The second time, I bet I brought, and I'm serious, I bet I brought like over 100 people. I had people sneaking in. Like, I had kids, kids I skated with that snuck in that weren't old enough to go to bars. Everybody, every single person I could get there. And this was so long ago that, like, especially in Sioux Falls, like, the comedy club was there, but stand-up comedy wasn't as big of even close to a thing as it is now, so people are like, oh, interesting, I'd love to go. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, it was hilarious. And then they even said after the show, they're like, yeah, you had like 3/4 of the crowd that voted for you. That's weird. And I'm like, yeah, well, what do you do? I guess I just know what I'm doing.
You played it off like you did to bring everybody?
Straight up lying.
Oh, you worked at that comedy club later, right?
I did. I worked there for years. So after
that, what you won by winning the competition, a job there?
Kinda. So they didn't have any open mics or anything. They just had this. It was a contest that you could do, and if you won, then you got to host at the club. So I won, and then the next week I hosted. I did terrible. And then the week after that, I did really well. But I was really, 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 really dirty. Like, I said some really, really dirty stuff. So it got cheap laughs from. Now I look at it and I'm like, oh, they were just laughing because I was saying crazy shit. But either way, they were laughing. So the manager talked to me after the show, and she's like, hey, I don't want you to freak out. This is nothing more than it is, but that was way too dirty. You can't do that. And I thought they were going to fire me, but she's like, we want you to come back. We want you to... I guess she saw something, but she said, she's like, we want you to keep coming. We want you to grow as a comedian here because we think that there's something there. You just can't. You have to clean it up. So
that was
my first real, like, slap on the wrist, like, hey, idiot, don't put
right.
in the house.
And then, but yet, the fact that she was able to see, like, oh, this cat's going to be something, I'd love for him to grow here.
That's why I don't write people off immediately, because I was the exact same way, because I was just some kid from Sioux Falls who thought it was, you know, funny to say gross, gross stuff, because people laugh when you say gross stuff about, like, abortion and stuff, and you know, not to say that you can make anything funny if you do it right, but most people can't do that right, so you kind of have to stay in your lane a little bit. So that's why I'll really try my hardest if I see someone, especially at Helium, since this is where I spent my formative stand-up years in Portland. Like,
right.
if I see somebody, and I don't go give unsolicited advice, but I've specifically gone and, like, sat next to people before so they would ask me things. I've done that a few times. Just so they would, like, open the door, and I could be like, well, maybe, you know, like, steer, you know, try to do this. Focus on this other stuff that you're also good at. And, yeah, because if somebody would have seen me, I would have been written off quickly.
Well, I think the easy, I don't know if easy is the right word, but if you are making, like, just saying wild, outlandish shit, you're going to get some laughs, but those aren't necessarily the laughs you want. Those are more laughs of like, cool, that's crazy that you said that. That's not like a, oh,
totally.
You're a skilled professional. And then then on top of that, you're automatically going to alienate some people who are like, I'm not trying to hear this shit.
Of course. Well, you know, and dude, you don't know what's happened to someone. I mean, sometimes, you know, sometimes people, like, I run into it now. Like, sometimes someone, if their dad died a week ago and I'm doing all this shit about my dad or something, and they, you know, they're going to hate it. So you kind of, you know, you don't want to bum anyone out. That's never what you're shooting for. You
right.
Want everyone to have as good a time as they can. So, yeah, it's such a, so many layers to it that people don't see, and they shouldn't see. Like, I don't know anything about coding. I just go to my skateboard websites and watch skate videos. I don't know how to make a website. So people don't need to know all this stuff to go enjoy a show. It's just, it's funny to think about, and hopefully people can appreciate sometimes when they step back, like, oh, it's not just getting up and being funny. There's a lot, a whole lot to it. Like, there's a lot of things that go in the sauce.
Well, I think stand-up now is so much different than it was even 8 years ago, because, I mean, even for, like, the 12 people who stumbled into this, they're interested in comedy and in the process. And I think there's a lot of comedy nerds who I even see come to the club who study it and love it and appreciate it for what it is. And I don't know if that was the case 10 years ago, where someone would, like, enjoy it even knowing how much work it goes into. It was more of, like, a magical and make me laugh by just going up there and saying, so when I was walking to the club, this guy showed up, you know what I mean?
I think
that might have a lot to do with podcasting now too, where people are more invested in comedians and they want to know the process more.
Well, podcasting is such a personal thing too. I mean, you know, people kind of, you forget again, because, you know, you're just sitting there with your friends, but sometimes people come to shows and they say, like, some pretty personal shit. And I'm like, how do you know that? And then they'll bring it up, and I'm like, oh, I completely forgot that I said that. Like, you know, I have people come up and ask me how Laura's doing, and it's funny. And it's never been anything weird, but it's just like, since I feel the same way with all these skateboarders that I listen to on the Nine Club, where I'm like, man, I know them, and they don't know me. They just told me about their entire life. And I know where they live, I know where they're from, I know what their dog's name is, and they don't know me from Adam. So it's funny. It's fun how it lets people into that personal side. And I'm thankful for it, because otherwise I would not have a job.
Well, you'd probably be working at a call center or something, but
dude, they're still open in Sioux Falls.
No way.
Yeah. So I'm the loudest on Facebook I've ever been in this last week, but I was talking. I was like, you closed, or I'm never going into your bar again. And that's true, I'm not. And I'm going to have to not go into some of my favorite bars ever again, because otherwise I'm a hypocrite. But yeah, they kept their bars open for so long. And I would say something, like, I'd make a post, and people would come at me like, well, then don't go, you baby. And I'm like, bro, that's not what this is about. And and so many people back home don't realize that, like, if you get sick, you're going to be fine. But when you go to the grocery store and you get your 12-pack or whatever, and then the person behind you is buying, like, fucking skin cream or something, and they're 65, and they touch the same register you touch, and then they touch their eye on the way to the parking lot, they might die. And it's hard to tell people that back home. So anyway, I've been really going after it on the book. But yeah, call centers back home are still open as far as yesterday. Maybe they closed today, but I highly doubt it. And they're like, that's cool, dude. I worked in call centers my whole life, and they are dear tay.
Yeah, that's the only job I ever tried to get fired from, was a call center job.
Yeah, so many people have that same.
It is. Job?
I never, I got fired from Hulu. When I first moved to LA, Hulu was a work from home thing. I was so excited. I finally got a job, and then 6 weeks in, they fired me because they said I was mean to people on the phone. And I'm like, I'm not. I mean, I don't have full confidence with a lot of things, but one of them is I'm not mean. I can say that with full confidence. And they were on this tip about, like, if somebody calls in and they forgot their password, you need to empathize with them. And I'm like, no, I don't. You just fix it. If I call in and I have a forgotten password, I don't want someone to be like, oh, I'm so sorry that happened to you. I don't give a shit. You know, change the password.
I'm so sorry that happened. That's horrible. We can get that fixed for you, no problem. Like that.
That's what they wanted me to do, and I'm like, what? Why not just fix it as quick as you can? Anyway, so call centers are still open. Bumming me out. Why am I talking about this?
I don't know where you got all this. So I, I, always ask when I end this, because comedy, I think, becomes more of a way of life. You know what I mean? It's like who you hang out with, and I think it does change you as a person somewhat. So, like, what has comedy done for you? Obviously, it's taken you from, you know, Sioux Falls to Los Angeles, in a major way. But I mean, as far as personally, how has comedy affected your life? What has it changed about you?
Everything. I mean, that's like what I do. I never, you know, I didn't graduate college or anything. I don't really have any like formal training as far as a career. Like that's the skill set that I have. It gave me something to fall back on. I mean, it has fed me. It has paid my bills. It's taken me all over the country. It's introduced me to friends that I'll have until the day I die. I mean, you know, even if I were to stop tomorrow, Ian would still be like my brother, Shane, David. They'd still, you know, those are people that I'll have in my life forever. I mean, that's how I met my fiance, essentially. Was I was doing stand-up, and she was on the same show, and now I'm going to get married, and she's... I couldn't imagine my life without her. I mean, it's given me everything. And it's easy to say that, like, you know, nothing would... Because that's how it goes with any job. Like, if I was like a delivery driver and I looked at my life, I'd be like, well, driving has given me everything. I met, you know, you're up. I met my friends at work and all that. So
I get the thing I think delivery driving doesn't give you necessarily is like, maybe I started doing stand up. Now I'm more confident, or I became a stand up comedian and now I empathize with the world better. You know what I mean? I think that there's something about getting into this profession, or even just doing it recreationally, that changes you fundamentally as an individual.
Yeah, I'll go a little deeper. So it had definitely confidence. I didn't have any confidence ever before. Like I had confidence on a skateboard, and I was always like a funny person. But like as far as social confidence, I would always look at the ground or like slouch. I could never talk to girls. But another thing, it's also shown me plenty of humility, and it's shown me the value of a dollar for sure. I mean, trying to pursue something like stand-up, when I lived in LA for the first like few months, I've said this so many times, I had 38 cents to my name. I remember walking the street, I was crying so hard on a pretty busy street in a non crying time of the day. It was like 2 p.m. where people aren't out there crying, and I was just thinking like, what am I doing? Like, because at the time I was long distance with my now fiance, and I was like, this is stupid, what in the world are you doing? I was out front of a Goodwill by the freeway a few blocks from my house just crying. So it's because you pursue something that is really hard. Not a lot of people, there is an easier way out, and it's to like quit or give up and get a different job, which again is absolutely fine, and I might have to do that eventually one day, but I haven't yet. And it's shown me that like if you do, you can do what you want if you really want to do it. I mean, a lot of people say like you can live your dream or whatever. We get emails almost every day from people, from strangers, that say like this podcast has helped them through some of the most horrific events I can imagine. Like, I won't get into it, but some of the stuff people say, it's just like, Jesus. And if I have any part in that, then I made it. I did it. I did what I wanted to do. So, you know, I've done it. I've lived my dream. It's happening right now. Like, I get to do this thing where we get to go on a tour this summer. You know, all the shows sold out pretty much. I mean, I have an album. I never thought I'd have an album. Me and Genuine, dude, we got albums out. It's just nice. Like, I feel like it's definitely given me an appreciation for things. And it's humbled me a bunch. And I know now that, yeah, you can do what you want to do if you really, really want to do it, if you have the right intention, if you're doing it for the right reasons. Like, I didn't ever start stand-up to make money or anything. I just was like, oh, this will be crazy to try. And then it evolves into something else. And then before you know it, you're like, oh, I'm doing what I want to do. I'm living my life. I'm living my dream. And that is insane to think that it's possible for people to do. So, yeah, it's given me a lot of perspective and shown me a lot about life. And also I've got to travel everywhere doing stand-up. Like, my mom will ask me now like where I am, and that's a funny question to get, because sometimes she doesn't don't know. And sometimes the answer is like, oh, I'm in St. Louis or Tampa or something. And, you know, it's cool. It's fun.
You're going to break me down and cry. anyway, so this is Comic Insights. I'm Nick Harris, Deshaun Jordan. We've been blessed enough to have them over the magic of telephones. 90.7 KBOO. Stay home. Stay safe. Thank you for listening. Sean, I'll talk to you later, my man.
All right.
Love you. Take care.
Love you too, bud. It's been real. I can't wait to actually see you again. But I'll keep texting and stay with you.
Absolutely, man. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Peace.
Peace. All right, dope. So I'm here on Comic Insights. It's KBOO 90.7. It's your man, Nick Harris, and I am joined by Amanda Arnold. Amanda, hello.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Please, thank you for getting on the phone and talking to me in these ridiculous times.
I'm super busy. I had to take a break from my garden.
Yeah, I heard the other day someone said, like, there's no excuse now for not answering a call. So
I would
be very pissed off if I got to you and you're like, too busy.
I am notorious for sending calls to voicemail or not returning texts for a little bit. And
Yeah. There's
just no excuses. You can't be like, I just didn't want to talk to you. I'm sorry.
Yeah. This is when people know the truth. So on Comic Insights, we're doing it a little different, obviously, this episode because we can't have people in the studio. So I'm lucky enough to have some really cool friends that will talk to me on the phone kind of about the process. So we're just going to start from the beginning. You didn't start comedy until much later in life, right?
Yeah, I was almost 31, and I'll be 41 in June. So I'm coming up on my 10 years. But yeah, I was older than everybody.
Why did you... Because I remember you told me a story once where you used to, like, do routines or something when you were in elementary school.
Yeah, the first time I did comedy, I was in the third grade. My parents were huge comedy fans. So I grew up watching stand-up, and I wanted to be in the talent show. And I had one of those, brutally honest moms. And she was like, you can't sing or dance. Here, I'll write you some jokes. So the first time I did it, I was in the third grade. But I used to memorize comedy specials. And man, my choice in comedy has changed. The first one I memorized was Howie Mandel. I loved Howie Mandel as a kid.
Oh, yeah, funny.
He was great. He was all his weird body movements, and he had Bobby, that voice he did. And then sadder note, my mom passed away when I was like 15, and I just kind of went crazy and, you know, partied a lot. And then I got a job at a bank when I was 21, and money was good. It was before the subprime market crashed, and I thought I'd work here forever. And went through a layoff and broke up with a boy, and I was like, I should probably do comedy. And that was 10 years ago, almost.
I mean, that's the perfect kind of genesis for, I think, most people is when you have a dip in your life, and you're like, I got time to do it. Why not do it?
I got a big severance. I had money set aside, so it was the perfect time to start. And, you know, and also being... I don't ever want to be so happy that I'm not funny anymore.
We're gonna get
I always
to
need
that.
To be a little sad.
Yo, so speaking of being a little sad, what was your act in third grade? Did you do well in the talent show?
Dude, I killed it. I was not scared at all. My parents were worried that I was going to get up there and balk. And I remember even what I wore. I had high-waisted Lee jeans on.
That's crazy.
A white button-up shirt tucked in, Mork and Mindy suspenders that were rainbow-colored, and my hair in a side ponytail. And I only remember one of the jokes. I remember it was something like, my mom tells me that I need to eat all my food at dinner because there's starving kids in Ethiopia. And I told her to give me a envelope and a stamp, and I'll send them mine.
And the crowd goes crazy.
They went wild. I mean, it's sad Netflix wasn't there. something.
It's hilarious. So, like, your process now, do you write everything? Because for people who don't know your comedy, you're very, like, kind of off the cuff, and it seems very funny, and you have really good material, and it's hard-hitting, and it's impressive. Do you Oh, yeah. Are you a kind of person who is writing all this down, or are you coming up with premises and then taking it to the stage, or how do you come up with your material?
Both. I don't just sit and write. Like, a lot of new comics haven't worked or they're just still going to open mics, they'll be like, hey, can we hang out and write sometime? And that's just, and I feel like this is for a lot of comics after you get a little bit more tenured, that I will get a really good idea. If I'm telling a story or something funny happened, I put it in my phone, and that's where it lives for a while. And then I'll write it out once, just so I can cut all the fat off of it and what doesn't really matter. And then I take it to the stage and I never write it again. It's all from there. But man, I have jokes that I've been churning for 3 or 4 years sometimes before it's where finally it'll hit a spot where you're like, oh, that's where it is. Okay, that's, I mean, it comes down to just a head nod can make a difference, or a pause, or it's amazing.
I love that you brought that up. I had this conversation with Sean Jordan earlier. There will also be an interview on this. And we were talking about how there's times when you'll have a premise or a joke and you're like, this is hilarious, this is going to kill, but it takes so many years before it even becomes something that people laugh at. For you, do you have anything like that where you're like, yo, this is premise that is going to murder, and then you take it to the stage and you're like, hey, Velcro shoes, and nobody cares? And then it takes you a long time to kind of flip that into something that works. Do you have anything like that off the top?
Yeah, for a long time, I was trying to figure out a way to talk about, because I did a lot of drugs when I was, 15 to 20. Right. And you want to bring that up on stage, and it's off-putting to some people. Either they're recovering addicts, or they've never been around drugs, or they've lost a loved one to drugs. So I do talk about, like, I have a line where it feels weird saying lines when you're not on stage, but I'm always like,
it's god awful, but I guess the silver lining of this is you won't be having a stage to say jokes on for a minute.
Oh, it's so sad.
I
know. My garden's gonna be awesome though. I asked the audience, have you ever had somebody pay you back money they owe you in drugs you haven't done? Those become drugs you've done. And that was where I could kind of go in, and now I'm opening up more and starting to talk about some of the experiences I've had. But it was really hard to be able to bring up doing hard drugs on stage. I never, did heroin or nothing against any people that have. I've never, I partied. But you got to be really careful. So, yeah, I think talking about real life stuff is really hard, and it takes time on stage to get there. Like, I wouldn't tell a new comic that was just starting to open mics to maybe really try to delve into some life experiences on stage, because sometimes you share too much and people are just trying to have fun.
Right.
And so maybe start with some lighter subjects. So I don't know if that really answers the question, but trying to tell more of my life experiences on stage that might be a little darker has taken a lot of time. It's taken like 4 years to really, and I'm just getting there. So.
No, yeah. So like with a lot of new comics, my thought, if anyone asks, I'll tell them, like, get funny first. Like, learn how to tell jokes before you talk about how, my mother, this happened in my life. Like, don't get dark until you can get funny.
You have people like Doug Stanhope that comes out and, does some of the darkest stuff ever, and these kids grew up watching him, and they're like, I'm going to do that too. But you don't see the bowling alleys and the retirement centers or wherever, all the work they put in to get that to where it's funny.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people forget that a lot of these people are icebergs, right? Like, you see Anthony Jeselnik and you're seeing the peak of the iceberg, and oh, that's so funny that he can say this stuff, but you don't see, like you said, the bowling alleys or the hours and the bombs and everything underneath the surface that he did to be able to build that ice cap.
And they all want to be cutting edge and push the envelope and, tell jokes about, gender and race. And I don't remember I think it was Chappelle that said it in an interview once that was like, yeah, you can tell jokes about gender and race, but you better make sure it's funny.
Right.
And that takes a couple of years.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, and then there's times where people will try to come out and talk about like abortion or something wild like that. And they're not
funny. Like, they're just saying stuff to say it, and you might get a laugh or something, but it's shock. It's not a real well-crafted joke that'll stand in an audience.
Yeah, and I mean, you being there, I mean, you're there for every show at mm-hmm. the club, and you, after a while, you find yourself, I don't know, like, there's comics that you see that you're like, oh my God, they are so genuinely and innately funny. Like, right. as a comic, they make me want to go home and rewrite everything I've ever done. There's a few comics like that. But then you see people that are getting huge laughs, but they're just saying the most absurd things they can. And those are frustrating because you know that they're where you want to be. These are headliners that are making really good money for a weekend. And because mm-hmm. not everybody is a comedy fan, they just want to go out and laugh and have a good time. That you're right. like, it's not funny.
Stop laughing at
Stop laughing.
I was about to say at a racist puppet, but Jeff Dunham could be listening to this radio show. I don't want him to not ever come.
I was like 9 though. You know, I didn't know that the jalapeno on a stick was super racist. I didn't get it yet.
No, I mean, there's plenty of things I used to watch and not know what they were, but I think the difference is we're deep enough in the stand-up that we know when it's art. And I don't want to try to make it sound ridiculous or clown people who are, you know,
no.
pulling their pants down and that's what people are laughing at. But I think someone who can honestly craft a well-written bit, they're doing something a little more than just getting a chuckle or a laugh off of shock value.
Yeah, and when you get really good wordplay, and there's a few comics that I've seen do that. My first feature weekend at Helium was with Nate Bargatze.
Oh,
and
yeah.
No fat on his jokes. They're super clean. You could put him anywhere. And his delivery is so dry and so southern that I think if people haven't seen him, when he first comes out for maybe the first 5 minutes, they're like, who is this?
Right.
And then he's so relatable that you're like, oh my gosh. And what I liked about him is he's so newly famous, whatever you want to call it, because of the stand-ups, he'd come in the green room and he'd be flushed, like his cheeks would be flushed, and he'd want to talk about his set because he's still excited and loves comedy. And I don't ever want to lose that. I hope that he doesn't either. Like, or you still love it so much that when you have a really good set, you're like, that was awesome. I don't ever want to lose that love for it ever.
Well, I don't think you will, just because you're like 10 in already. And being 10 in, I'm always curious to when, at what year did it start to kind of click for you? So, like, when you first, you're 31, you got this money, you got no boyfriend, like, let me try these mics. What kind of jokes were you out there doing?
It was a different time in Portland then. It was fun. It was so fun because it was the wild, like, my version, and I know, like, it's all perspective. Like, I mean, I'm sure Susan Rice, who's like our oldest comic in Portland, who's still very relevant, I'm sure she has crazy 80s stories. But when I started, it was Ron Funches, Ian Carmel, Shane Torres, Nathan Brannon, and it was everybody just saying what was funny,
but
not being. It was like everybody was saying what they wanted to say and not worrying about offending people, but we didn't offend each other because they were writing and they were being smart in the way that they did it. So
right.
there's a difference about than, you know, going up and just saying whatever you want to say to hurt a specific group of people versus noticing small things about groups of people and then having them relate to it. And it was wonderful.
Yeah, and I guess to go a little deeper into it, when did you start realizing that, all right, people are I mean, Portland has a rap of being very PC, right? I don't find it to be the case all the time, but it is something to it. When did you start feeling that shift from, hey, we're just up there saying whatever, to like, oh, I got to watch what I say?
I would say about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
It was weird. I went on the road too early. I lied like a lot of comics and had a headliner that didn't know me from out of town
yeah.
who ended up being crazy, but he was like, how much time do you have? And I was like, oh, I have 30. And I
and then you're on stage like, so where do you work? Cool. And where about you?
I had probably 12 minutes. I went to Reno, did a casino down. It was crazy. But I would say that I went on the road for like 2 years after that with a bunch of like Seattle headliners. Right. And then I was still doing open mics and stuff in Portland, but it shifted when I was working out on the road that much. And there was this, I wasn't aware that there was a stigma with younger comics about being like a quote unquote road dog. Oh, road dogs, they're like, you know, they're dirty, or they don't, you know, they don't work clubs. And I came back and I was like, well, you can put me in any bar, any club, anywhere from here to wherever, and I'll know how to do it now. Like, there,
right.
You got to get out of the yard. You have to, you know, take off the leash. And when you get out there, I had a lady in Pocatello, Idaho, come up to me one time about a soccer joke. She was like 6'8" and had the word Susan tattooed on her neck. She was the meanest looking lady and told me if I ever talked crap about soccer again, that it'd be the last thing I talk crap about. And I'm like, you guys have teeth.
Just for the record, you could curse on this radio show. It's after 10 o'clock.
Oh, okay.
I just have never heard you say crap ever. And I was like, what?
I was on top of it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. But no, yeah, it's after 10. So you can say whatever the fuck you want to say.
Awesome. But I was like, do you guys even have a team? And then I came back anyway, and everybody had gotten younger and more PC. And I'm not an anti-PC person. I don't think you should get up there and be terrible. But there was definitely a shift, and that shift pinned. There wasn't as much camaraderie in the scene. It's gotten better over the last couple of years. I feel like we all like each other again. But there were certain people in the scene that made it uncomfortable for others, based on all of the "hey, we shouldn't be bad people" stuff.
Mm-hmm. And for people who don't know, so you run the Dirty Dozen show at Helium.
I do.
And you are known for, I guess, being more of a dirty comic. But like you said earlier, you can open up for Nate Bargatze. Like, I'm not saying this to say this is like a disrespectful thing, but you are very good at being like a dirty comic, because it's not dirty for the sake of dirty. It's just adult material.
Because that's who I am on the inside.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to get to. So do you think that being that you started older in life and that you have gone through things, it helped you with that material? Or is it just because you think, hey, I've been dirty since day two?
I think that starting later was good for me. I think that life experience. I'm also, you know, I'm a woman, I'm a 40-year-old woman, so I think that I started in my prime. I mean, I think that women are in their prime from like 30 to 50. I don't know. It's like a 20-year period, probably. So, and dating and being single, and crazy shit happens to us, and it's too funny not to share. excuse me, I'm so sorry. Say that, yes, it helped me. Yes, I am kind of a... It sounds weird to be like, I'm a naughty, dirty girl.
Yeah, it sounds real weird, especially on the telephone.
I think dirty stuff's funny. Like, I remember watching, my parents didn't censor anything, though. I remember watching Raw when I was a kid and crying because they were laughing really hard and I didn't get the joke because it was like, I was like 9, so I didn't get the joke. So I think I was also raised on dirty comedy. I'm also, since my mom passed away when I was 15, I was raised by all men.
Yeah, that's rough.
Lots of dick jokes growing up, lots of them. So I think that all goes into it. But also dirty comedy is what most people start with because it's easy. That's why street jokes are out. The funny street jokes are always dirty.
Straight up, yeah.
It's an easy laugh. I will say that I've noticed that my comedy is shifting over the last two years, where I am talking about more than just dating. People like the dating stuff, man.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think people... Because I think you're right, actually. I think people really do dig dating stuff. Why do you think that is?
Because dating and marriage. Either you're dating and you're like, it's cool, I'm going to die alone because I keep going out on these dates with these people that are garbage. Or you're dating and you're happy, and you're like, oh, these are things that I notice about my partner, and people like to relate to that. Dating's relatable, even if you're married. And that's why a lot of the married, the comics talk about marriage. Anytime a comic gets married, I'm like, oh, you got a new 30 minutes. They have a kid. Oh, you got a new 30 minutes. Because that's just more to talk about.
Oh, I agree. I think there's some people who go out there, not necessarily to be relatable, but to, I hate the word, like, to teach or to, like, inform And then there's people who are out there kind of to be more relatable. Do you have a preference with that? Like, I would say maybe like a Chappelle versus a Brian Regan. I mean, those are the, you know, the pinnacles and the top. But I do think there's a difference between those two comedy styles.
Oh, 100%. The,
do you have a way you lean? Or?
Oh, I totally lean to relatable. Like, yeah. I don't want to. You can learn.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.